I'm going to be talking about a topic today that I think is really, really important. Really, 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 really seriously important. And it's about truth. I'm going to be talking about truth. And the reason why I think this topic is very important for today is because I think that truth is under attack. I think that we live in a time and in a world where I think it's very common for people to reject the idea of absolute truth and actually think, hey, truth is relative. We live in a pluralistic society where we say, hey, there's a lot of different types of truths and they're all true and they're all true together. And so we don't like the idea of people thinking, hey, I think I might have an understanding of what truth is, whether it's biblical truth or anything else. And, you know, so like we see in the news these days, there's this situation with cancel culture. Basically, hey, nobody can determine truth. Truth is not absolute. I get to decide for myself what is true and what is not true, the things that I want to believe. And I'm going to create a world for myself. I'm going to create a belief system for myself. And it used to be that, hey, I'm going to have my own belief system and you go and have your belief system and that's fine. But there's been a shift, I think, over the last 5 years or so, where that's not okay. Just that moral relativism and just saying, hey, everything about truth is relative and we can all believe different things and we can move together. It seems like that's shifted to, hey, this is what I believe and what I believe is now the absolute truth. And what you believe, if it's different than what I believe, is something that makes you a bigot. You're clearly dumb or crazy, or you're somebody who hates human beings. And there's just this thing that's in the ether where, you know what, if I don't agree with what you have to say, I'm going to shut you down. I'm not going to let you speak. I'm not going to let you speak your mind. You know what, if you behave in any kind of way and you say something that might offend anybody, then you might be at risk of losing your job. And there's just this thing also about being triggered. This is like a word that growing up I didn't really experience before. But there is this idea that even if by accident you say something that could potentially cause you to have emotions that are negative, then you're a bad person and you should be prevented from being able to do that. There are also problems because right now, the way that people experience knowledge, experience truth, experience news is through social media. And, you know, we hear in the news about fake news, how people will just broadcast things and say, hey, this is what's going on regarding the climate. Hey, this is what's going on about so-and-so. This is what's going on about this company. And nobody really goes to the trouble of going back and checking to see if those things are actually true. And there is this new word called gaslighting that's taken place where, you know what, it doesn't matter if it's true or not. You just say what you want to say, and the other side's going to say the opposite of what it is that you're going to say. And it doesn't matter that maybe there's this gray area, that there's this happy medium, or that maybe both sides are wrong, or both sides are right, or both sides are half wrong, half right. No, it doesn't matter. This is what I believe. This is how I feel. This is absolutely true. And I don't care how much you want to say the opposite and how much evidence you have of the opposite. It doesn't matter. I'm going to stick to my truth, and you believe it. There's this problem with truth these days. And actually, from what I've seen, there is a problem for us as Christians because we believe in the truth. We believe in Jesus Christ who says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. He says, there's no other truth. There's no truth besides me. I am the truth. The gospel message is the truth. And so how are we supposed to operate as Christians and as churches in this kind of a society where by simply saying that, look, there's one truth, there is an absolute truth. God is absolutely true. And all the things that he says is true. And it's up to you to reject him or not. And because of that position that we're taking, where we're not relativists, where we're not pluralistic in the way that we go about believing things, now we are considered bigots. We are considered people who are closed-minded, that are holding on to old thoughts, old ways of living, and that it's unacceptable. And I think that there is something that we can learn out of the passage today that can help us in our journey in being able to live in this kind of a society. How can we be faithful to Jesus, the truth, and how can we live in such a way where we actually live out a life where we are caring and loving and understanding of people that have opinions that might be different from us? And so with that, I'll go ahead and ask you guys to open up your Bibles to Titus 1, verse 10. And we're going to be reading from Titus 1, verse 10 to Titus 2, verse 1. For there are many who are insubordinate, empty talkers and deceivers, especially those of the circumcision party. They must be silenced, since they are upsetting whole families by teaching for shameful gain what they ought not to teach. One of the Cretans, a prophet of their own, said, "Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons. This testimony is true. Therefore, rebuke them sharply, that they may be sound in the faith, not devoting themselves to Jewish myths and the commands of people who turn away from the truth. To the pure, all things are pure, but to the defiled and unbelieving, nothing is pure. But both their minds and their consciences are defiled. They profess to know God, but they deny him by their works. They are detestable, disobedient, unfit for any good work. But as for you, teach what accords with sound doctrine." Now, even as I'm reading these words, there are some harsh words that Paul says are true. It's up to you to believe them or not. But Paul is saying that these things are true. And he says, Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, and lazy gluttons. Now, imagine in the society today saying something like that about any group of human beings. Just think about it. Or saying things like, they profess to know God, but they deny him by their works. They are detestable, disobedient, unfit for any good work. Paul, how do you really feel about the Cretans? And just think about it. Imagine if you toned this down to only about 50%, 20% of what Paul really meant. And he changed it to, I think, you know, some Cretans tend to have a tendency to be lazy gluttons. They tend to seem to lie a lot. Can you imagine how this culture would receive something like that? They would reject him. They would call him a racist. They would call him a bigot. They would actually want to cancel him. They would send all kinds of emails and letters to the Apostolic Foundation that Paul's a part of and say, "You must fire this man. How dare he say anything like that?" Imagine what it was like for Titus to receive an instruction like that. "Hey, Titus, you're going to live on Crete for the rest of your life. You're going to die at the age of 94. You're not going to know anything other than Cretans and living on Crete. And you're supposed to love them, and you're supposed to serve them. And you're supposed to turn these people who are always lying, that are evil beasts and lazy gluttons, and you're going to turn them into the types of people that we're going to be able to set in as leaders and the purveyors of truth for this world." Can you imagine what Titus was thinking? "Oh my gosh, people are going to hate me if I confront people about the truth." And you know what? Paul isn't saying, "Hey, look, Titus, these are the things that are true about the Cretans, and so you know this, and you operate with this knowledge." He actually says, "This testimony is true, therefore rebuke them sharply that they may be sound in the faith." Hey, you are not allowed to just take this truth that I'm telling you about the Cretans and just have it as your own personal knowledge and just leave it at that. Actually, there's an opportunity for you to confront them for these things that are not in line with the gospel and make sure that you have a role in seeing a transformation take place in the lives of Cretans and in the lives of the people of Crete. And you know what? Though Paul is smart, he's smart in that he doesn't say, "I, diligent Paul, who was always bivocational and I planted all of these churches and I also supported everybody and I was this tent maker, decide that the Cretans are this way." He's actually engaging in the culture. He's learned the culture. He spent time with them and he's also spent the time to be able to learn what Cretans said about themselves. And apparently there was this philosopher. He was called a prophet because there were some mighty kind of works that he was able to engage in. His name was Epimenides, and he was the one that said this about Cretans, which included himself. So in some ways, he's actually calling himself a liar and an evil beast and a lazy glutton. So this is just an aside, but there's this philosophical dilemma with this statement of Epimenides where he says, "Hey, Cretans are always liars." There's a problem with that because he himself was a Cretan. So was he lying when he said that Cretans are always lying? And there's this example of having a card, and on the front of the card it says, "Hey, the thing that's on the back of this card is true." And you turn it around, and then that part, the back of the card, says, "Hey, the thing that's on the other side of this card is false." And then you're like, you turn it back around, you're like, okay, wait, so this statement that the thing that's on the back of this card is true is false? And then you turn it back around, wait, how does this make sense? And you end up in a paradox. And, you know, I just say that in jest. Obviously, if it was just based on the comment by Epimenides, maybe we can disregard it, but it's something that Paul is able to confirm, and we can assume that this was the case, and that there wasn't an adornment of the gospel among the Cretans, and that there was some change that needed to come about. There needed to be a restoration and a transformation that was in line with the gospel message that Paul and Titus had preached. And so what are some of the things that the Cretans were dealing with? And in past sermon series, I talked about Aristotle, how Aristotle had this philosophy that actually work is beneath us as human beings. You know what? If you're somebody who works, especially if you're somebody who works with your hands, it means you're a less than sophisticated human being. We who are enlightened, we who have resources and are able to do the real things that human beings should be doing, we will be able to separate ourselves from work, and we'll be able to just sit around and think philosophically. We'll be able to go to school, which is why actually the root, the Latin root for the word school actually means leisure. It was something, going to school and just thinking about ideas and thoughts was something that people would do if they didn't have to work. They were obsessed with politics, oh, who was the emperor and who were the people that were supporting the emperor. And they would go around and each of them would have patrons, people that would financially support them. And so your job was to go around town and talk bad about the people that were supporting the person that was going up against your patron. And so you were gossiping, you were empty talkies, you were busybodies going around from place to place just chatting about nonsense, not really engaging in work. They were also obsessed with myths. They were obsessed with mythology. They were obsessed with astrology. They loved to look into the skies. They liked to think about the Greek gods like Zeus, and they liked to think about what the implications were on their lives. Hey, maybe Artemis isn't happy with me. Maybe Ares isn't happy with me, and I need to do these things to bring more blessing and favor into my life. They were obsessed with calendars and doing things according to certain rituals and observing certain days to be able to have blessing in their lives, which is why that naturally, before the gospel transformed them and the way that they were thinking, that they would have been susceptible to these empty talkers and these deceivers who were coming. Because the people of the circumcision party would come and they would say things like, hey, you know what? It's not just about love. It's not just about obeying God. Actually, there are all these things. Oh, did Paul and Titus come and tell you about Jesus? Yes, yes, yes. That stuff about Jesus, that stuff is true, but there's so much more. And they would open up their Old Testaments and think, you got to do all of these things. Remember, look at these genealogies. Look at all of these calendar rituals that you have to observe, all these rites and things in order to be able to cleanse yourself. You need to actually take a knife to your children. You need to circumcise them in order for them to really be able to please God. There were all these things that they were trying to get them to do. And because of their background, because of the existing worldview and the things that they believed and the things that they had been doing for generations, for them, that was attractive. Oh, that makes sense. You know, when we go around town and evangelize and meet new Christians, it becomes very quickly about, well, what am I supposed to do? There's this word, piti, about ceremony and rites and rituals. What are the things that we're supposed to do if we are a Christian? And, you know, I talked before that actually our walks with God, being a Christian, means more than just love and feelings, that there are things that our loving Father asks us to do, but it is primarily about love. It is primarily about a relationship that we have as we are reconciled by the gospel. Yeah, but what are we supposed to do? How do we make this God happy? What can we do to make our lives better? It just is a question that human beings naturally have because the gospel is offensive. It's actually receiving something for free, which is not natural according to our human nature. Actually, this thing that the Cretans were experiencing that Paul was talking about was something that was a problem throughout the churches in the Greco-Roman world, and which is why in another letter similar to Titus, Paul writes to Timothy in 2 Timothy 4:3, "For the time is coming when people will not endure sound teaching, but have itching ears. They will accumulate for themselves teachers to suit their own passions and will turn away from listening to the truth and wander off into myths." And you know, actually, as a Christian, I think more than ever, in terms of just my experience of being a Christian, being on this earth for 40 years, I don't think that this is any more true at any point in my life as it is today. People don't want to hear about truth. They don't even want to talk about it. They don't want to talk about what's right and wrong. It's just all about experience. It's all about subjectively what are the things that I am interested in, that I am willing to accept. And more we have these ears and we're able to find people in our culture. We can even find teachers in the field of academia. We can find other Christian leaders or Christian people, authors, who will tell us the things that we want to hear that are in accord with kind of the things that we believe being a part of the culture that we are today. And this is why Paul wanted to encourage his true children in the faith, Titus and Timothy, people who were going to carry on the truth of the gospel message, to be able to pay attention to this thing called truth. And there are a number of different references throughout the New Testament where there's warnings about false prophets, false teachers, just meaningless things, empty gossip, myths and genealogy and things that were going to turn people away from the truth. Ultimately, at the end of the day, this was the thing that was the problem, that there were going to be people, whether it was through Satan working in their lives, whether it was through their own selfish motivations for gain, were going to teach things that were not in accord with the gospel truth and were going to turn people away from it as they had already turned from it. And the whole point of Titus is to try to address this point. And the importance of truth. And John Stott puts it this way, and this is why Paul was encouraging Titus to put things into order and appoint elders. And the reason why is because, as John Stott puts it, this is to say, when false teachers increase, the most appropriate long-term strategy is to multiply the number of true leaders who are equipped to rebuke and refute error. We need to be convinced that this is possible. The last comment is something that really struck a chord with me as I was preparing for this Sunday, that we have to be convinced that this is possible. And, you know, I think it's easy for someone like me who is here specifically for the purpose of evangelism and discipleship and church planting. And you know what? It's actually quite easy to get on that boat or that plane to be able to come over here. I came on a plane, not a boat, by the way. And it's actually easy to go around and begin to see and preach the gospel and tell them the truths. But it's another thing to actually walk with people for an extended period of time, being kind of a spiritual father and a mother for people, rather than just a servant who delivers a message and is on their way, like a Lazada delivery person, but actually staying with them and being able to walk with them in such a way that over time, that there is an opportunity for people to be able to understand the gospel, to be able to accept all of its truths, and to be able to demonstrate it in their lives as a fruit of what the Holy Spirit is working into their lives. And you know what? I'll just be honest. There are times when I'm thinking, oh my gosh, how can we change a culture? How can we change the mindsets of people that have lived their whole lives with a certain philosophy or a certain belief system? Is it even possible? And this is the thing that Paul is wanting to make clear. He says, I wasn't able to finish this. I had to move on. But God is calling you, Titus, to remain here and make sure that this happens. And, you know, I told you last week that he spent the rest of his life trying to do this. And you know what? We'll know when we get to heaven to what degree he was successful in seeing truth take root in this kind of a way. But regardless of whether we're actually able to see the results that we want, God is still wanting us to continue to pursue serving him and people in this kind of a way as our long-term strategy. And, you know, I want to talk about the idea of truth and why it is today that people have such a hard time with truth. And the reality is that the truth hurts. Not all the time. Truths like you're a beloved child of God and he loves you no matter what. He's never going to turn from you. He will never forsake you. He'll never leave you. And you're going to be able to enjoy all of eternity with him. Those truths are easy to accept. But truths like the things that Paul was focusing on, negative things about us, you're lying. Lying is not good. You're lazy. Being lazy is not good. Those types of things hurt. And I think that we live in a world nowadays where actually people don't want to know the truth because truth can be inconvenient, truth can be ugly, truth can hurt. But there are a group of people who cannot avoid truth, who cannot avoid it. There is no way, because even in our best attempts to try to sugarcoat things, to try to make people feel comfortable, actually, even in our inadvertent stares and our glances, we will speak truth to them in ways that are deeply, deeply painful. And for some reason this week, God really put on my heart people that have facial disfigurements, people who are burn victims, people who were born with cleft palates, people that have been in car accidents and other things that make their faces look not like what maybe their original design was from God or what they were supposed to look like. And, you know, one particular person's story really compelled me. He's an Australian man named Robert Hogue. Has anybody ever heard of him? And Josh, if you could just put a picture of him up. Okay, this is him. And he actually is the author of a book, a series of books. He's written them for adults. He's written them for young adults and kids. It's called Ugly. And, you know, the inconvenient truth, the ugly truth in Robert's life, there's this saying, right? Like if somebody is not very attractive, you might say, it's a face that only a mother could love. Well, the ugly truth for Robert Hogue was that he had a face that even his mother couldn't love. And this is what he looked like at the time of birth. He was born, and at an early point in his mother's womb, he had a tumor that was forming on his face, and it was such that it messed with the shape of the rest of his face. He didn't have much of a nose. It actually pushed his eyes out to the sides like a fish. And when he was born, the question that his mom had wasn't, is it a boy or a girl? The question was, what's wrong with him? And she didn't want to see him. She couldn't stand the thought of seeing him and didn't see him for the first week. And after being in the hospital for a week, she went home not having seen her son and not knowing what to do and not feeling like she had the capability to be able to actually be his mom. And so he stayed in the hospital for about a month. Thankfully, his father said, hey, this isn't right. Like, this is our son. He's still your son. We should bring him home. But then they were talking about, well, do you know what the implications are? Every time we go places, we have these other kids. He had brothers and sisters. And you know what? People are going to stare at him, and our kids are going to feel insecure. They're going to feel weird. They're going to always have to answer the question of, what's wrong with your brother? But what the parents decided was, let's let our other kids decide. And you know, the wonderful thing about kids, they have such childlike faith. And truth just comes naturally for them. Believe me, my kids have called me fat enough times for me to know that they have no problem with truth. And they voted, and they say, hey, this is the situation. This is your little brother. This is what he looks like. Should we bring him home? And one after the other, all of the siblings said, yes, bring him home. We can love him, and we can take care of him. So he comes home and lives at home until the age of about 4. And then his parents decide, we cannot allow him to continue life living in this kind of a way. He's not going to be equipped to be able to face the world. We need to give him a face that's more normal, that's more in line with the way that other people look. We need to help him to be able to not get rejected, not get ridiculed at school, and be able to be accepted. And so they talked to some plastic surgeons, and the plastic surgeon said, okay, well, you know what we can do? You know how actually it's not just his face, but he's got a problem with his legs. You know what? It turns out we're going to have to amputate them. And we can take some of the flesh from his foot, particularly his toe, and be able to try to construct a new face for him. So we're going to take off the tumor, and we're going to build him a new nose with a toe, and we're going to bring his eyes together, and he's going to have a more normal face. And but this is the caveat, is that there's a 25% chance that he's going to die. And Robert's dad said, wait a second, wait, what are you talking about? Okay, I understand that if we go through with this procedure, he's going to look a little bit more normal, as people would define normal, but it doesn't mean he's going to be 100%. And you're saying that there's a 1 in 4 chance, a 25% chance that he is going to die and we're going to lose him? And so there was this debate, there was an argument, mom and dad didn't get along. The mom said, no, we want to be able to prepare our son to be able to live in this world, and it's worth taking the risk. If you are not going to support me, I'm going to run away, I'm going to take him by myself, and I'm going to make sure that he gets this procedure that is going to help him. And ultimately, they decided to allow him to go through with the surgery. And so this was him at 4 years of age. There's one before this, should be. No? Okay, well, there's a picture before this where, actually, we can go to that picture, the next picture. This was him later on in life, at the age of 14. They've done the procedure, and they've amputated his legs. He's on a prosthetic leg there. His left leg is a prosthetic. And at the age of 14, now he's a teenager. And now, you know what? There were kids were making fun of me, and it was hard. My life's been hard, but I have a loving and supporting family. I have brothers and sisters who can take care of me and back me up. But by the time he got to the age of 14, he started to realize that, hey, like, what kind of a life am I going to have? Is it ever going to be possible for a girl to be attracted to me? Am I going to be able to get married? Am I going to be able to have kids? Is this like present suffering that I'm experiencing, the thing that I'm going to have to experience for the rest of my life? These were brutal truths for a 14-year-old to try to think about. And so his parents, who had been talking to the doctors all the time, they said, hey, you know what? I think let's take another crack at it. I think we can do more to try to make his nose look a little bit more proper. We can fill in some of the space that was left when his eyes were moved. We can move his eyes another centimeter closer. And maybe at that point, he will look good enough that he's going to be able to live in society and live a relatively normal life. But here's the catch. There's a 25% chance that he's going to lose his sight if we go through with this procedure. And so the parents thought, man, this is brutal. This is really hard. We can't decide. We already tried before to do it the first time. Let's leave it up to him. And he actually feels like at the age of 14, he wasn't ready to make that decision. But his parents said, hey, this is your life. You're old enough now to make decisions for yourself. You decide, do you want to go through with this risky surgery? And what he says is that as he was thinking about it, he didn't really know what he was going to do. And this was the promise that was being made to him. The next photo. So this is obviously not him, but this is a CGI image of what was being promised to him. That if he went through with the procedure and received the surgery, he took that risk of losing his sight, that maybe he might look more normal like this. This was the thing that was being promised to him. And as he was sitting around the table with his family, he was talking to each of the siblings, they all gave an opinion. And then his older brother chimed in. Thank goodness for older brothers, right? He said, wait a second, this is so stupid. You're saying that if you go through with the surgery, there's a 25% chance that you're going to lose your sight? What good is it if you have a pretty face if you can't even see it? And he said that at that moment, this thing solidified in his heart. He said, I had allowed my face to belong to other people. I had allowed my face to belong to the world. They got to decide what was beautiful. They got to decide what was normal. They had got to decide what was acceptable. And that I was just trying to meet their expectations. And in that moment, he says that I owned my face. He said, it was mine. I'm okay with it. I don't need any surgery. I'm going to live the rest of my life with this face. And he rejected the surgery. He accepted this truth. His brother, who probably wasn't actually thinking about speaking truth to him in this moment, but just said the thing that was so obvious. It's like, so what if you have a good face? If you go blind? And you know, the reality is, even if you receive this thing, people are going to always be able to know and see your scars. And there's no guarantee that just because you get this surgery that all of a sudden women will be interested in you, that you'll be able to get married, that you'll be able to have this life. Robert, you were born different. Your face is ugly. And this is something that he's comfortable using, actually. This is a man who is really comfortable with truth to a point where his book is actually called Ugly. You're ugly, and it means you're going to have a harder time in life than people who are attractive. It might mean that you're going to have to go about life alone. It might mean that you're not going to be able to have kids. It might mean you're not going to have the same job opportunities because people are going to notice this thing about you. And for him, it was this acceptance of these truths that were painful and ugly and inconvenient that he started working towards being able to grow as a person. And you know, became this amazing champion. He's an author, and he's a motivational speaker, and especially helps people who have facial disfigurements like him. And as I was looking at his story, there was another person's story that I saw. He was burned as a young boy. He was cleaning things with some gasoline, and it caught on fire. It ruined his face, and he said that, you know what, when I first saw my face, I didn't think it was that big of a problem. The doctors were warning me, my parents were warning me, and I saw the first time in a mirror, and I thought, hey, this isn't so bad. And then he started walking outside, and the people couldn't hide their looks. And I have experienced something of this. One time, I was doing something really foolish, moving a piano by myself. It shattered my front two teeth. And, you know, I'm quite a funny and kind of confident guy. And for a couple of days, I actually ended up having to live life with these two front two teeth missing. And, you know, like at first I was like, yeah, this is funny, kind of. And I can tell the story of how stupid I was trying to move a piano by myself. But you know what? People can't help themselves. And they're not trying to be mean, but they stare. And then they'll look at you, and then they'll notice your teeth, and you can see all of this happening, and then they'll look away. And they'll have a conversation with you, not making eye contact. And you know what? Like gradually, like, and it didn't take long. In a matter of days, I was feeling really insecure about my face and my teeth, and I was covering my mouth when I was meeting new people. And so it wasn't necessarily about self-image. It was the reception that you were getting from other people that was so painful. And this burn victim, he actually said that he got to a point in his life because he was able to turn it around, but for him, he needed to grapple with this truth as well. He decided that, yes, this horrible thing happened to me. I don't look the same. People don't treat me the same. Now I have three options. I can go and jump off a bridge and not have to worry about it. I can sit in this chair in my house and never go out and never see another human being again in my life. Or I can actually go on with it and understand that this is the uncomfortable truth of my life, but I'm going to do that. And there is one particular psychologist that I looked into, and he was born with a cleft palate. And you can tell he struggled with it, the same things that you might experience from a facial disfigurement. And as a psychologist, what he told the parents was, don't ever tell your kids that they are beautiful to you. Don't ever tell your kids, oh, you're still beautiful. Don't ever tell your kids that you look beautiful. Because when they go outside and they see that reality is not true, now not only are they hurt, but they realize, can I trust my parents? Or are they just lying to allow me to hear the things that they think I want to hear, the things that I need to hear? He did say, you can tell people with facial disfigurements, you're beautiful. Not, you look beautiful. And lying to them, or possibly lying to them, but you're beautiful. You're still a wonderful, created image bearer of God. You're still beautiful. So, back to Robert, this is a something that he experienced in the recent years. He made this friend named Nick. This is a really hard name, Stathopoulos. Nick Stathopoulos, another Australian artist. And one day, Nick said to Robert, hey, I don't know how you're going to take this, but I want to paint you. I want to paint your face. I want to do a portrait of you. He was a portrait artist, and he was somebody who did realistic portraits. And he thought, yeah, what's the worst that can happen? Nick's my friend, so I have to sit still for a couple of hours. It's not a big deal. And he said, sure, no worries. I'll let you do it. And so he sat for this portrait, and when he had an opportunity to actually see what his friend Nick had painted, this was his response, and his words here are just so beautiful that I had to share it rather than paraphrasing it. And when he saw the painting, the portrait that his friend Nick had done for him. This is what he said. "And I went into his studio and looked at this massive portrait of my face and just stood silent for 2 whole minutes. Now, until then, I thought that owning my face meant that no one else could own it. But I looked at this portrait, disturbed, voiceless, silent, crying, because it seemed to me that Nick had gone and owned my face for me. It seemed as if this portrait captured every piece of pain, every bit of life I had felt since I was 14. And I think the important thing there is plenty of other people will try to own our faces, but have they put a million brushstrokes into owning our faces?" It's just incredible statement. And the next picture is his friend Nick, who, this is the portrait. And the next picture is his friend Nick. No? Okay. Anyway, it's just this incredible thing of, you know what? My friend, I gave him an opportunity to draw a portrait of my face. And in the era of filters and beauty face functions on cell phones, rather than trying to make his friend Robert look more beautiful than he actually was, he did as realistic of a painting or a portrait as he could, and even put his hurt, his pain, his grief, the difficulties experienced in his life into that painting itself. And he realized that there were all these people that were trying to own his face and say, "Your face is not acceptable. Allow me to perform surgery so that you can look more acceptable." He realized that he was this friend who was joining him in owning this uncomfortable reality. There was this friend who was joining him in owning his face, and he was willing to pay a price. He was willing to pay the price of a million brushstrokes to be able to join him in this uncomfortable truth. And I want to ask you, friends, in your relationships, in your friendships, with your children, with your family members, are you somebody who is willing to spend the million brushstrokes to join them in truth? Or are you saying, "That's too costly, I don't want that, I just want it to be easy and comfortable for me, and so I'm going to sugarcoat things, I'm going to lie to them, I'm not going to tell them truth when is necessary"? Ask yourselves that. And I can tell you that as somebody who is tasked with coming up here Sunday after Sunday and preaching the truth, it's not fun, it's not easy to speak truth to somebody. I don't know if I'm good at it yet. Because, you know what, like everybody else, I want to be accepted. I don't want to be rejected. I want to be liked. I want to people to think, "Oh, that Dan, he's a nice guy." I don't want to risk at times in being able to speak truth in case it might offend somebody. It might make them not like me. It might make them want to reject me and not want to talk to me again. Are you comfortable with ugly truths? Are you comfortable with speaking ugly truths, necessary truths, to people? Are you willing to inconvenience yourself in order to be able to join them? Are you willing to pay a price to be able to be a good friend and join them? And, you know, I just want to be clear that I'm not saying that we just go around speaking truth to people all the time. You know, we're not supposed to have Tourette's and just say, "Hey, Brent, I don't like your hair. Hey, Hannah, I don't like your shirt." We're not just like speaking truth. There's a specific truth that we're talking about. And the specific, I like your haircut and I like your shirt, by the way. I was just giving it as an example. That was me being a jerk. The truth that Paul is talking about, that Titus is talking about, that was a part of their common faith, the thing that needed to be adorned, I think is described by Tim Keller in this way. The gospel is this: we are more sinful and flawed in ourselves than we ever dared believe, yet at the very same time, we are more loved and accepted in Jesus Christ than we ever dared hope. This is the beautiful dual reality, the dual truth of the gospel, is that we are all Cretans. Let's face it, we're disobedient, we're unfit for any good work, we're liars, we lie all the time, we're evil, we're lazy, we're gluttons, There just is a reality that we're sinful and we're flawed. But we can't go about our living our lives as if that is just not true. Because it takes away from actually the second part of that thing. And at the same time, we are more loved than we ever dared hope. That's the full truth of the gospel. And that's what we're supposed to be speaking into the culture. It's what we're supposed to be speaking to our friends. It's what we're supposed to be discipling our disciples to be able to learn and live out as well. Truth and love is not just about being nice. It's about speaking the whole truth, even when it's costly for you. And for Titus, he spent his whole life in Crete speaking truth. For Paul, it was the sole reason for him to live. For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. If I am to live in the flesh, that means fruitful labor for me. Yet which I shall choose, I cannot tell. I am hard-pressed between the two. My desire is to depart and be with Christ, for that is far better. But to remain in the flesh is more necessary on your account. Convinced of this, I know that I will remain and continue with you all for your progress and joy in the faith. So for Paul, he had a really hard life because he was about the truth. He was beaten. He almost lost his life several times as a result. He was hated, imprisoned, all of these things. And for him, he was suffering so much that he longed to go to heaven and be with Jesus. But he said, you know what? The reason why I think it's better for me to remain on this earth, if I could see you raised up in the faith, if I could see you adorning the truths of the gospel, then it will be worth it for us. So it's just this difficult task that God is asking us to join him in paying a cost to be able to see come into fruition. But how do we do it? How do we do it? And, you know, I just want to share this little picture out of Jesus' own life. A man with leprosy came and knelt before him and said, Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean. Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. I am willing, he said, be clean. Immediately he was cleansed of his leprosy. So here's this person with leprosy who was a pariah. He was rejected by society. Kids were encouraged to throw stones at them. If you saw a leper coming, they were supposed to shout it out so that you could go to the other side of the street and be able to walk around them. And this leper is confronted with the truth of Jesus, that this might be the Messiah, that he might be able to bring help. And he comes and kneels, and actually it would have been perfectly okay for Jesus to just run the other way and say, you are unclean, I am clean, I am the promised Messiah, I'm a clean rabbi, I dare not touch you, I'm a holy man. And Jesus does this amazing thing, and you might not notice it if you're not paying attention, but it says that he went out and touched the leper. And initially the people probably seeing him do that, but you're going to become a leper too. But for Jesus, it's this, you know what? I'm going to join you in your ailments, in your sickness. I don't care if it means that I get leprosy. Don't you know that actually you have a bigger problem with your sin? It's a much bigger problem than your leprosy. And I'm going to join you in that. And I'm going to go to the cross for you, and I'm going to die. And I'm going to heal you, and I'm going to clean you. That's the Jesus that we're to confront our friends with. He is an inconvenient truth. There's an opportunity for us to be offended and hurt. But why would you want to turn away from this magnificent of a truth? And, you know, the thing is for him, it wasn't just about dying on the cross and being obedient to the Father. But he so fully joined us in our experience. He definitely paid the million brushstrokes in order to be able to own our truth with us and for us. And this is what is said of Christ in Isaiah 53. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he was borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed. This is the thing, friends, is that we all have an ugliness in the spiritual realm
that God says, I love you as you are, but I love you too much to just leave you as you are. If you will come to me, if you will come to the truth, I will use my own wounds, I will use the blood that flowed from my veins, and I will make you new again. I will make you perfect, just as I am. Why would we reject that? Why would we reject that magnificent truth? Dear Lord, we thank you so much for who you are. We thank you for your word and what it says about you. That it's possible for us to accept and receive information that might hurt us, might offend us, make us feel uncomfortable, make us feel bad. We're able to do that if it's a part of the glorious truth of what Jesus was willing to do for us. And Lord, we just have to confess that there were many times in our lives when we weren't good friends, where we didn't love one another by simply being honest. There have been times when we've been empty talkers. There have been times when we've been deceivers. Lord, there have been times when we were searching for flattery, when we chose to be deceived, because we were scared. We were scared about hearing bad things about ourselves. We were scared about saying anything in case it offended somebody and made them reject us. Jesus, I just pray for my brothers and sisters here. And I especially pray for the young people who live in a different world than the one I grew up in, where truth is less tolerated, where there is a tyrannical mandate of tolerance. Lord, I ask that you would heal them, that you would touch them. Would you allow them to, through your kindness and your gentleness and your love, to be able to receive truths from you? And would you allow the restoration and the healing that they receive at your hands, empower them to be able to do the same for the people that you put into their lives? In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.